Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner, and for Carrie Miller this morning. We're talking business and climate change. I know you don't often hear those two together in the same sentence, but climate change is increasingly burrowing its way into your favorite company's business model. So how are companies reacting? Let's ask. Laura Bishop is Chief Sustainability Officer with Fortune 500 Best Buy. Adam Fetcher is Vice President of Environmental Impact and Policy for Clothier Askofinlayson. And Chris Farrell, you've heard him here before, is Senior Economics Contributor with APM's Marketplace. Welcome, you guys. Laura, let's start with you. Best Buy is one of 17 Fortune 500 companies in Minnesota. The political winds in Washington clearly blowing in a less climate-friendly direction. Has that changed how you at Best Buy are approaching climate sustainability at a corporate level?
So we've been at this for a long time. So in 2009, we set a goal to reduce our carbon footprint by 45% by 2020. Mm-hmm. We recognized that we are already exceeding that goal. So we just went in and reset our goal, 60% reduction by 2020. And I would say with political climates, certainly we watch that. But this was something we were already on track doing, and we have accelerated those. More so than political climate, it's the recent events that we're seeing all over the country that drives our urgency for this.
Such as?
Such as hurricanes that we've seen, any of the wildfires, all the natural disasters, earthquakes too in Mexico. All these have impacted our customers and our operations. We know that this is a real issue, not only for us, but for all of our customers. And so there's urgency to act.
Talk to me a little bit about that. When extreme weather, climate-enhanced extreme weather events, as we like to accurately call them here, sure. Are they showing up in your supply chain, in your business model? How does that impact your operations?
So they're showing up in our supply chain as well. But when I really look at it, we're looking at it right now at the domestic impact that we're seeing. So we still have two stores that are closed in Puerto Rico. Half of our stores in this past year were impacted in some way by climate-related events.
Wow.
So it's a big cost. And it's really what we think of at Best Buy. I mean, we really look at our family, our employees. We had 600 employees that were impacted by these disasters. And that costs both the company money as well as these employees such hardship. And if our employees are suffering this much, we know how much our customers are as well. So that's what drives some of our attention and our urgency.
So this is not really just a PR, a feel-good move. It really does have an impact on your employees. And the bottom line, is there a return on investment to being climate-friendly for Best Buy?
Absolutely. So I would say that it's definitely a return on investment. We see that from both the impacts to the operations and the investments that we make in our people, but we see that in the investments that we're making in our business. While it may cost us money to put in all of these energy retrofits and lighting retrofits, we get that money back. And it's these efforts that we're putting forward with our climate reductions actually are saving the company money.
Chris Farrell, let's talk about the bigger corporate picture here. Before President Trump, it seemed like the train had already left the station with many climate-friendly companies and adopting those practices. Is that train still rolling in spite of the shift in Washington?
Absolutely. And I think there's a couple things that are going on, just building off of what with Best Buy. If you think about the competition for talent, and we have a very low unemployment rate nationally. Look here in the Twin Cities, mm-hmm. how low our unemployment rate is. So in the competition for talent, one way that you reach out to people is you say we are sustainable. And by the way, it's not just a press release. It's not just a marketing gimmick. We're not just giving some money to our foundation to do some feel-good things. But we actually really are trying to affect the way we do business. So I think that's going on. And there's sort of two particular reasons. One is many of our corporations are global,
mm-hmm.
and the rest of the world is embracing global climate change. That's why it's called global climate change. So even if you were going to make some adjustments here and go a little more slowly, you have pressure in China, you have pressure in Europe. So that pressure is there. And why would you walk away from that? And then I think on the local level, you have a lot of businesses that are really tied to the local community, the sustainability of the community. Their customers care about that community and sustainability. And so when you take all the trends that are going on together, you're going to keep moving forward.
Adam, we hear how the big companies approach climate change. Why would a regional clothing company like Asko Finlayson focus on climate change?
Well, I think this fall, as I was coming on board with the company, we really found ourselves at two inflection points. The first for our business, we've been a small retailer here in the Twin Cities, a shop in the North Loop, but we're really looking to position ourselves for significant growth and really becoming a national clothing brand in our own right. We've seen a lot of momentum around this idea of the North, which we've championed. You can see it in the branding of the Super Bowl. All the sports teams locally are using it, and we're committed to making sure it's a movement for good. The second inflection point, as Laura and Chris were describing, is about climate change and the urgency of the issue. There's just signs all around us that not only here in the North, but around the world, people's lives are being impacted. Minneapolis has been rated the number two city in terms of impacts of climate change in the entire United States. So we've got a lot we need to fight for. And our model is all about making sure that we are being fully accountable for the climate cost of our business and then some.
So let me ask you essentially the same question I asked Laura, which is, how do we know this isn't just a PR ploy designed to boost sales? What's the actual benefit of a climate-friendly business model for you guys?
Well, I think sometimes we lose sight of the word sustainability, and it gets to be meant a sort of a green feel-good initiative. What it really means is setting the business up for long-term success. And that requires, if you're taking a long-term outlook, that accountability to the planet and to people that's so important. So in the coming year, we're going to be performing our first comprehensive carbon footprint analysis for our entire business, starting at the raw materials in our supply chain and to our company operations. And we're going to be showing our work to make sure that our customers are understanding the work that we're doing, our methodology, how we're doing our math, and bringing them along the way.
Laura, I'm curious about Best Buy's customer base, what they think about climate change. Is there demand for climate-friendly practices from your business?
There is, and we recently did some research with our customer base to understand this. We had seen these trends. We sell more Energy Star appliances than any other company in the world, and so we knew that there was interest there, but we just recently did some research with ours, and I'll say a little bit of these stats.
Please.
More than two-thirds of consumers would consider investing in technology that would make their home more environmentally friendly. We found that, you know, in our research. We also found that millennials and Gen Xers, certainly in our customer base, but also in our employee base and our prospective employee base, as Chris was talking about, millennials and Gen Xers are most interested in the environmentally friendly products. 94% of millennial men surveyed said they would consider investing in smart home technology that would make their homes more environmentally friendly. So there is this real interest in these technologies, and it's both driven by, I think, the coolness factor of these technologies, but also that it saves them money and it is the right thing for the environment.
And I think a couple of things with companies, if we go back 10, 15 years ago, probably 15 years ago, a lot of this discussion of sustainability was about the cost, right? That was how it was framed, as a cost.
Yes, sure.
But many companies are looking at it as a source of innovation and new products. If you look at what Ecolab is doing in terms of water and expanding into parts of the globe where there's water shortages, and how do you have a hotel when you have water shortages and using zero water, having a zero water impact. So it's about innovation. If you look at Walmart, it's about saving money, saving a lot of money. And then it's also looking at your customer. So I was at a presentation, and it was a wonderful presentation about the artisan bread community. They really want to know, okay, what field was that grown in? What sort of chemicals were used? I mean, they really want the information. And so that was being provided to them by a major multinational corporation. Now, what they also said, and this is what I admire, they said, now there's another division. This is in a totally different business. And when they call up the customer and say, well, you know, we were charging you $10. We're now going to charge you $10.50 because we're going to do some initiatives. They say, if you don't charge us $9.50, we're taking our business elsewhere. So one of the challenges I think that is happening is that you, the customer, in responding to the customer, companies can be incredibly information, sustainability, good information. You can have another division where nobody cares about that. Mm-hmm. And people will lose their jobs and people won't get their bonuses. And you can't discount that. So it's not hypocrisy that's going on there. It's changing the nature of a market.
You know, the takeaway there for me is that the artisan bread people are going to save the planet from climate change, right?
That's well, if you expand that, if you expand that out and you start asking yourself that question, it's the response to the customer.
Chris and Laura are both exactly right. In a time when our politics are frankly not doing the job in taking care of the planet and creating a sustainable future for, you know, our children and our children's children, people increasingly want to vote with their dollars and make choices to support companies that are aligned with their values and also succeeding in business as well.
Speaking of voting with your dollars, Chris, I wanted to touch base with you on this. The city of New York making big news last week. They're suing the oil companies for damages from climate change and divesting from those companies. Does this look like a one-off to you, or are you seeing a trend here?
Oh, there's definitely a trend there. You look at Norway and the world's largest state-run fund. You know, they're also making a move along those lines. So, you know, if you take a global perspective, look at what's happening with China and the investments in alternative energy, and you look at the employment here in the U.S. involved with alternative energy, this is all part of a pressure that is ongoing, whatever is happening in Washington. And you can explain to me what's happening in Washington, because
sure.
I'm sure I'm not going to understand that. But, you know, that is Wall Street. If you went back again 10 years ago and you looked at Wall Street research, I mean, they could have cared less. Mm-hmm. It was like this thing, you know, this used to be this thing called ethical investing. And all that they, you know, look,
it was a
you
conference.
Just invest
some
in cigarette companies,
to.
Get a high dividend, and then, you know, just give the dividend to charity. I mean, that was the attitude, right? Now, ethical investing, responsible, socially responsible investing, this is a huge part of Wall Street. Yeah. And it's the same thing that's going on with sustainable development, responsible development. And you're also seeing, now you always have to be a little bit careful with these studies, but basically it makes sense that there's a reward to investors to investing in companies that take a sustainable perspective, a longer term perspective.
That's right.
It's not 100%. And there is, you can get in that greenwash thing and you can get into hypocrisy and all that, but that's where the pressure is growing. So, no, I don't think New York is a one-off.
Mm-hmm. No, and I will say that we're seeing, from Best Buy's perspective, an increased interest in our shareholders as well as our institutional investors in the sustainability initiatives that we have. They're asking for more information on our programs, what we're doing, and that long-term view. So we're really proud of it. We have a lot of good information to share. And those are almost always, I would say, positive, you know, conversations because of where we stand in our Newsweek rankings as number 6 this year, which we really are proud of, or being part of our CDP Climate A List, which is a real boon to, you know, our efforts of what we've been doing. Investors look at those things and they're asking more about what we're doing. Also another reason why our board of directors is involved. I report annually to our board of directors. I regularly share updates on our sustainability initiatives with our board of directors because this is of interest to the long-term health of the company.
How about your employees? Is there a buzz within the company about that?
Oh, yeah, they do. They love it. And I'd say both from the sustainability aspect as well as our communities and what we're doing from a community engagement aspect, our employees are really proud of the work. So when we put a story up there about, you know, achieving number 6 in the green rankings for Newsweek, they're so proud of it. I mean, it really does instill pride and they trust that we're walking the talk and doing this. I mean, they see it too in our Geek Squad fleet. We transitioned those over to hybrid vehicles. We're saving 140,000 gallons of gas by our transition to this. So they know that both these are cool cars as well as it's a good investment and it's good for the business.
Adam, I'm curious about your view from a less Fortune 500 sort of perspective here. What's the ground truth for small and mid-sized companies in Minnesota when it comes to climate change? Is it on people's business radar, so to speak?
I think increasingly it is. I think, you know, small businesses like ourselves are seeing an opportunity to really embed a climate-focused business model into what everything we do early on so that as we grow that that model scales with us. I think there's that same idea of a customer and employee enthusiasm for quote-unquote green initiatives, ways to be, you know, basing your business on doing right by the planet. And I think that that's really encouraging for small and mid-sized businesses like ours. I will say, though, I'm really encouraged by what Laura is talking about and what they're doing at Best Buy and what Chris described in terms of the investor community really starting to demand this kind of accountability. You look at what BlackRock said in terms of making sure that publicly traded companies are still holding themselves to account for the planet and for people. You know, too long, I think the big Fortune 500 publicly traded companies have been held hostage by the quarterly earnings demand for maximum profits. And the truth is, you know, courageous decisions to, you know, extend the idea of success to long-term implications involving business success that's dependent on a planet. I like to go back to David Brower's quote, "There's no business to be done on a dead planet." I mean, that's just the fundamental fact of where we are, and the climate crisis has reached that peak. We all need to be listening to that no matter what size company we are.
Okay, this is all wonderful. But talk to a number of startups in the Twin Cities who have wanted to do sort of a sustainable approach, investment in sustainability. But the thing is, you also have to stay in business.
Yes.
And what they found is it's expensive. And it's not easy, and it takes a lot of extra work. And so a lot of times, I think it's important that a business person, an entrepreneur, may have the idea about being sustainable. But I always like the way Kim Bartman discusses it with her restaurants is she really cares about sustainability, but she has to have profits first. And that allows her to continue to make those kinds of investments. So a lot of businesses really do need to move slowly in this area before they're able to do it. And the other aspect that I also think that is important, and this is one of the things that's good, is there's more and more data and more information out there, which also means that companies who are going to say, we're doing really well, there's actually increased data saying, no, you're not. You're not thinking about this right. What about this? And so I think the accountability. So when Askoff is doing its wonderful stuff, which is great, but they're also going to have a lot of customers out there going to be running some data and saying, hey, you're saying you're doing this, and guess what? This is the effect of what you're doing. So you've entered into a very different dialogue, and there can be costs to that dialogue ongoing.
So is it a question of scale? Is it easier for a Best Buy to be climate friendly, climate sustainable than it is an Askoff?
Depends on what kind of market you're getting into. But yes, I mean, they have, again, it's responding to your customer. If your customer base will reward you for making these investments, then yes, I do think that it is easier. I think if you're a startup and you just, it's like many startups want to start out offering their employees, they got three, maybe four employees, they want to offer them health insurance. They really do. But if you're starting up, offering your employees health insurance and a retirement savings plan, that's a real cost. And unless you have deep pockets, you have to say that is a goal. This, or maybe I'll help you go to one of the exchanges. But that is a goal. Starting it up front, if you're going to be sustainable, offer health insurance and offer a retirement savings plan, you better have a really cash flow rich business up front.
You know, I would argue with that just a little bit, because I think, you know, waiting for customer demand to emerge is really not going to cut it when it comes to the climate crisis. It's upon us. It's too problematic for us to wait for the customer demand. I think it really requires courage from business leaders, large and small, to act first and make that first move. Otherwise, you're sort of waiting for a chicken and egg scenario, and we're all going to lose out. I think what we're excited about our business model is that we're doing the calculations that will allow us to bring the financial cost of our carbon emissions into the decision-making room at every step of the process. And I hope that by succeeding, that we can show that this kind of model really isn't too expensive, really isn't too cumbersome. When you start small, when you make it part and parcel of everything you're doing, it's achievable.
I think it also is going to depend on your business, right? So you mentioned it, that there's all of these emerging products that are out there too. And that we just came back from a Consumer Electronics Show. so interesting what's emerging there. So here's these startups, but they're investing and designing these green products to the point where you see the health and wellness products that are out there. They measure the air quality. They measure the drinking water, you know, quality. There was this technology where on your sunglasses, the size of a Tic Tac that could detect, you know, the UV rays so that you could understand, you know, what was impacting you from a consumer standpoint. I mean, it's really interesting. So while they're depending on your business and your business type, certainly a lot of sustainability is driving these businesses as well.
It's a little scary for me. Pretty soon we're going to have a virtual weatherman right on your sunglasses.
We can never replace you, Paul.
I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. You're listening to a special edition of Climate Cast here on NPR News. How are businesses in Minnesota and beyond forging ahead with climate-friendly business models despite anti-climate change winds from Washington, D.C.? Laura Bishop is Chief Sustainability Officer with Best Buy. Adam Fetcher is Vice President of Environmental Impact and Policy for Askov Finlayson. And Chris Farrell is Senior Economics Contributor with APM's Marketplace. Laura, we talked a little bit about this. 2017, an incredibly damaging year for climate change, enhanced extreme weather. We know these extreme weather events are increasing. The data is showing that. Are companies like Best Buy seeing that extreme weather show up increasingly in the supply chain, like you talked about? And I know that some things happened to one of your plants in Southeast Asia, perhaps?
Certainly. So several years ago, we had a plant in Asia where flooding impacted that. So what is happening to us, and that increases the cost of, you know, the product, but and as well as the time that that product can get to store.
So that plant was down?
It was down.
Okay.
And I would say what we ended up doing, and it was a six-month delay, mm-hmm. what we're looking at more and more in those is how you diversify your supply chain so that you're not having all of them in one space. And I think more and more you would hear that from General Mills. You'd hear that from most companies that have large operations like that that are so reliant on getting those products to market that you have to diversify your supply chain.
Well, absolutely. And part of it is for good reason, which is that wages in China are going up. And this is a wonderful thing. So some of the cost benefits of moving operations to China, you know, have eroded. You had the tragedy of the nuclear meltdown in Japan, which had a big implication for a lot of these extended supply chains. So just echoing what you're seeing is we still live in a global economy. And so more and more there's a sense, okay, I need a presence in North America. I need a presence in Europe. I need a presence in Asia. I need a presence in Latin America, and rather than I need a presence in one Asian country and I'm going to put everything on a container ship. And that's a fundamental shift reflecting both stronger economic growth in Asia and higher wages, but also concerns about these extended supply chains.
Chris, I'm a physical scientist. I know that earth changes don't always happen smoothly. We're seeing more of that. They're often sudden. They can shift and have catastrophic events. Things change quickly. And as somebody who watches these things, how are you seeing these environmental impacts affect corporate business models?
Oh, I think it's starting. There's really is a lot of discussion. And the discussion's moving from the discussion into trying actually to take it into, to turn it into financial numbers. So there's a great deal of the quantitative scientists are really trying to take what you're describing. Okay, so how do you translate that into a cost of business? So if I'm thinking about an investment, I can make some sort of guesstimate about what is my rate of return going to be. I'll take a look at the cost of oil and what that might be. So how do I start factoring in changes in the climate? And where you're seeing some of the real investments are being made is in one of the most fascinating industries in the world, which is the reinsurance industry. And if you think about the reinsurance industry insures insurance companies. Mm-hmm. So the first 10 years of a risk is the insurance company. But then after that, so 10 to 20, 30 years, that's the reinsurance company. And so no surprise, if you look at the practical application of what does global climate change really mean, a lot of that is being funded by the reinsurance industry because they are the ones that are on the hook.
You know, I'm wondering what's the relative impact here, the weight of positive climate action in the future, corporate versus government? Adam, you're a small to mid-sized company. How do you view that?
Well, you know, I've had experience on both sides. I worked in the Obama administration at the Department of the Interior and the Department of Homeland Security, both enormous organizations that have both working to mitigate for climate change and also significantly impacted by climate change and are also working to push policies to help improve climate change. That certainly was the case under the Obama administration, at least. And unfortunately, we've taken several steps backward in that regard. And I've also been at Patagonia, a large-scale retailer with a really complex supply chain, and I've gotten to know the complexities involved with a global supply chain and all the great information that Chris was just referring to. I guess I feel like in this moment, it's really incumbent on business to move the needle forward. I think that whether or not that consumer demand exists, the long-term health of the business and the long-term health of the planet are one and the same at this time. And so I think business leaders who are taking courageous steps forward and innovators who are bringing to market the amazing technology we're seeing at CES and other places, that's really where the action lives. And so, you know, I talk to my friends and consumers, again, who are looking at who's on the cutting edge. And I think it's supporting businesses that are really innovating on behalf of their own long-term business success and the planet that are leading the way.
You know, I think a lot of us look at this and see the irony here that business seems to be leading the way on climate policy, when in Washington, the folks who generally are pro-business seem to be the furthest behind on this. I don't want to put anybody in on the spot or in a box here, but does anybody have any perspective on that dynamic right now?
Well, and also, you know, just building off of this is that you can look at places like Miami. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter what their politics are. They're dealing with global climate change right now. Down in Louisiana, I mean, they're struggling because they'd really like to say it's not happening, but it is happening. And so I think part of it is also on your state and local government level, depending on where you are, there's also some activity going on. But in terms of our national discussion, there is an ideological trap. And it's one of the more puzzling and disappointing ideological traps, because if you go back to the 1970s and the Environmental Protection Agency, it was, you know, the environment was considered one of those bipartisan. There was a lot of Republicans who, particularly out in Colorado, in Utah, you know, really in favor of the environment. It was across, it was bipartisan.
Didn't President Nixon create the EPA?
EPA, he did, absolutely. And, you know, he was lauded for it by Republicans. And then when you look at things, concerns about sulfur and that we created the exchanges, you know, for trading, you know, again, bipartisan. So there was an ideological trap that has been fallen into. And for whatever reason, it's not possible on the national level to get away from it. But if you go to a place like Arizona, you're seeing really interesting political bedfellows. So the Tea Party and the environmental movement have united forces because they want solar power in their homes. The big public utility doesn't want this to happen. So you can get these sort of strange bedfellows on the local and state level, but politically, it's ideological blinders.
Well, you've seen that too with the religious community and climate change.
Exactly.
As well. So it's something that's coming together, all these business and religious community, and you're seeing different, you know, changes in partners that you wouldn't see before. And I don't think that's driven by government. It may be driven by inaction by government, but that's never why we started as Best Buy to get into this climate business, in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know, we started our recycling program years ago because people needed somewhere to bring their old electronics, and we were a logical place, and we wanted to be that place. So I think for businesses, we are going to lead. And we're kind of in a unique place right now. We're in Minnesota, right? Businesses have led for a long time in Minnesota, whether it's in the community or in the environment. This is a community of business leaders that have this heart and soul and this interest of a greater good. And that's, I think, I'm real proud to be part of that and proud to be in Minnesota where we're leading something like that.
But it does seem the only thing would be, when we're thinking about global climate change, is how fast or how slow do we respond? So the business community is doing a lot, and there's no question about that. But if you set the rules of the road, that's where Washington can make a big difference, is setting the rules of a road and then let the market work. Because the innovation of the market, of the American entrepreneur, of the foreign entrepreneur, you know, they can deal with a lot. So I think that's where we're disappointed in Washington and their actions right now. Stuff's happening. It's going to continue to happen, but it could be happening so much faster.
Well, and the irony is a country like China, which is obviously essentially government controlled with a huge business interest, is moving forward faster on renewable energy, much faster than the United States is. So, you know, there's that dynamic too. Guys, I predict the future every day for NPR weather. I'm going to ask you to look ahead a little bit. Adam, what trends are you watching for in this linkage between business and climate change in the next few years?
Well, our mission is called Keep the North Cold. And unfortunately, Minnesota is seeing its winters warming faster than anywhere else in the country. So that's really where we're focused. And as we go out and talk to people who live here in the Twin Cities or across the north or throughout the country, we really want to help them understand how our very best traditions, our winter traditions, the kind of stuff you're seeing happening at the Great Northern Festival and in the celebration around the Super Bowl right now, that's really what we stand to lose. Our identity in the North is fundamentally tied to our cold winters. That's where we get our spirit of hard work, creativity, ingenuity, and the love of exploration all year round. Without cold winters, I don't know who we are. I don't think we want to ask that question. So that's the trend we're looking at and what we're trying to fight for.
Laura, how about you? What do you see and what are you watching coming down the road?
So I would say that obviously 2017 was such a devastating year. And the hurricanes that we saw, you know, and the rising temperatures that prolonged many of those hurricanes and storms is something we're really concerned about. And we will continue to watch. I mean, getting our stores back running in Puerto Rico, I mean, that is a costly, costly effort. We continue to support our employees that are not working right now. So it's something that we've done that other businesses on the island and in Puerto Rico have not done. We've paid out $1.2 million to employees just to keep them employed, volunteering in the community, other things, because we know that we want those employees back working for us. So those type of trends where employees are displaced and our customers are so displaced are things that we're continuing to watch. But those, I think the hurricanes and the wildfires really surprised us in a way that we don't want to be surprised in the future. But those are trends we're real concerned about.
And I just want to touch on Puerto Rico for a minute. Is that a function of infrastructure and power? Are your stores damaged? Do they still not have power? What's the situation on the ground?
It was extreme damage to the stores. So that's part of it. It's getting materials on into the island. It took a while for the power to get back up. So that's part of it as well. But it's materials and getting those into the island. I have an employee on my team, on our environmental team, who's Puerto Rican. She was just back there visiting her family. And she said, yeah, they still don't have electricity where her family is. I mean, it's really, and she said the devastation is so real. So having her come back and tell us, you know, firsthand what's really going on is real touching and real. But the infrastructure pieces, the electricity, just how incredibly damaged that those stores were is, I think, the real problem here.
Yeah, climate change sometimes doesn't hit home until it hits home. Mm-hmm. Chris, what are you looking for?
You know, particularly looking at alternative energy, the surprise has been how far and how fast prices have gone down for solar, have gone down for wind, and also an intellectual infrastructure that has grown. I mean, what you do, you know, in terms of weather forecasting with wind power has really advanced, and there's more and more brain power going to that, computer power. So I think the alternative energy market is had something of a setback right now, but the momentum is there, the competition is there. So I'd really be watching that extremely closely. And then the other part I'd be looking at, because this is where global climate change comes home, and it's water. And whether it, you know, that's in Miami with what they're dealing with, you know, the risks of various flooding or the Everglades, or it's, you know, pollution in your water. You know, a lot of times this discussion is abstract. Global climate change. You're a scientist. You understand that. Okay, business is doing stuff. What does it really mean for me? And water, I think, is where it becomes very real.
Well, we're seeing a situation now where Cape Town in South Africa may be about 3 months away from running out of water. So it's
exactly.
Getting more real by the day.
And you can see, you know, for example, in Las Vegas, I mean, it's one of the things you really do have to admire about the casino industry. They really do adapt. They looked at the risk that they weren't going to have water. hard to be in that business if you're not able to apply for showers and drinks and all kinds of things. And they really made an enormous investment in order to, you know, get to a zero water usage, you know, recycling economy. And so that's what I would be looking at very closely.
Laura Bishop, Chief Sustainability Officer with Best Buy. Adam Fetcher, Vice President of Environmental Impact and Policy for Askov Finlayson. And Chris Farrell, Senior Economics Contributor with APM's Marketplace. Thanks for making us smarter on climate change and business today.
Great to be here.
Thank you. Great to be here.